So, welcome back, everybody, to Safe Space, our becoming extremely irregular podcast. We're having this kind of number. So, you're here with me, Robert, and
Davide.
And we're having a bit of a number confusion because I kept numbering the episodes consecutively, and Davide started the season 2, episode 1 last time. So, you can choose however you like it. The file has a season 2, episode 1, and the feed has an episode 9 on it for last one. It's the same one, in case you're wondering. So, what are we going to talk about today, Davide?
Good question. I had the same one. I think you gave me some homework to kind of watch a quite interesting video presentation from Buddhist Geek.
Yes. You can find, for those who want to know what it is, go to safespace2012.tumblr.com. And the link is there. It's a video from the Buddhist Geek Conference in Colorado, I believe, from the summer.
Yes. I think you had something in mind in terms of why you found that that video interesting. And maybe we can start with that. I found it really interesting in general.
Yeah, it's actually a video of, they call themselves contemplative scientists.
Yeah.
And they're actually neuroscientists kind of looking at the interaction between practice and anything that happens in the brain.
Yes.
And the scientist, she was pointing out that people have so much faith in science that if you show them any kind of brain scan and color the brain scan a little bit, you can basically make people believe anything.
That's right.
And she cited this one example that there was actually a real article, which I think I saw also on BBC at some point, that they had seen that the same regions in your brain lit up when you think about your lover and when you think about your mobile phone.
Yes.
And the conclusion the researchers had was, you're obviously in love with your mobile phone. Well, or at least that's what a lot of people thought when they read the article.
Well, let's admit the iPhone is quite sexy.
So a lot of people concluded they might be in love with the iPhone.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, I think it was just smartphone, but as you said, the iPhone is sexy. So they're in love with the iPhone. And this scientist, she actually said, well, she believes that the outer science of actually measuring brain activity has now progressed so much, and we kind of lack the inner understanding of what's happening in our brain and how to relate to things, that actually the inner understanding has to catch up.
But really? I thought she was saying that, you know, that's correct, that so the way she explained it is that it's almost a testimony to the fact that we have lost contact with our inner world, because we believe more some colors on a chart lighting up and some, you know, nice maps of on the brain. We have more faith in that than what we actually feel.
Yes.
So yeah. We rely more on external information than on what we actually have a direct access to, which is our own feelings.
Yeah.
Right, yeah.
And I found that very interesting because we actually have two very long-standing traditions in the West by now. I mean, we have the ancient tradition of Buddhism, which is really all about what is happening in your mind. I mean, that's the crux of it. And then we have psychology in the West, which now is also over 100 years old, which is also all about looking at what's happening in your mind. And so I'm completely straying from her point, but anyway, what got me interested in is kind of how do these two kind of disciplines then actually compare? Because I think we as Buddhists, and I might just speaking for myself, but we do kind of believe that we have a very good understanding, which might actually go beyond that of psychology of what's happening in the mind. And yeah, that was actually the kind of thing that was triggered in me, in my thinking. And then I was wondering, well, so how does Buddhism look at your mind differently from psychology? Or does it look differently at all?
But there's also a third element that I think we touched upon in one of our previous discussions, which is you're talking about Buddhism and psychology, but then there is a third thing, which is actually what most of us are immersed in, which is pop culture.
Yes.
You know, most people don't read, Jung and Freud, and then they don't, most people probably, I would say, don't go to a shrink or have access to that language even. And most people don't know about Buddhism. So this reminds me just a short kind of parenthesis. We are Skyping actually, right? You're in Leremling, I'm in London.
Yes.
And I took advantage of being in London for a couple of days.
To go to a
British shrink. I went to the Tate Museum of Modern Art.
Cool.
And just a short thing is to say that when you go to a place like that where you see, I wouldn't say really the latest and the loudest in contemporary art. I guess you would need to go to New York or places like that. But then you see the divide between what you would call like culture proper and pop culture. It's like you can say the West in general, has reached the state, in art, in the fields of art, we are in the postmodern, or probably post-postmodern, who knows where we are at. But, that has very, I don't know how much impact it has on everyday life of the people I see now here walking by in Caledonian Road,
Yeah.
I don't know that they're even aware that, Andy Warhol existed at some point. So just a brief thing to say that it's always also relevant. If you want to really discuss about the West and the experience that people have, you cannot just talk about the academic world or like the academic world, basically. You have to see how pop culture deals with that. And I think what she was saying is that in the way we live our life, most of us have little, if no contact with our inner world.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where then when we see a nice picture of the brain, we become all excited and tend to trust it because we have nothing to compare it with. It should be a normal thing to say, look, I like my phone, but of course I'm not in love with it. I don't care what the machine says. But people don't seem to do that.
That's a good point.
So that was a little aside.
Yeah, it's true, actually, the way you say it's actually very good because I'm not very familiar with psychology at all. And I'm almost kind of, very wrongly, but kind of using the word psychology for pop psychology. What kind of general people on the street kind of think of psychology, this kind of popularized use of psychological terms where nobody really knows the definitions. But everybody feels free to use terms like, I don't know, all kind of psychological terms.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, it's all about the inner, what we call the inner science, I think she called it contemplative science. But what I found really fascinating about that presentation was the level of detail this scientist was trying to determine in terms of contemplative science. She was quite hard on her colleagues in general, or on the academia in general, when she basically pointed out that now for a number of years they have been researching basically meditation and the effect of meditation and stuff like that on the body, on the brain, and so on. And they have done so in a very unscientific way, with absolutely no references of what, for example, the word meditation means. Are there different type of meditation, and do they have different effects on the body and on the brain? Are they using some sort of scale in terms of measuring results and even classifying methods? And she was all into that, and she basically convinced, I think, the health service in America, I think, to sponsor her, to pay her for 5 years to do Buddhist studies, because she realized, if I have to research this thing, and mostly I do it with Buddhists because they seem to know this stuff, I better know how they classify this, their experiences and their techniques, and the effect that those techniques have on the mind, and at least start with that, with their kind of scientific background, and then see, and that she moved into, like, with other scientists, they were then looking into how can we map those stages and those elements into maybe a more neutral language. There's no Buddhist language. And then we have almost like, you know what I mean, like a XY axis with some, you know, that if you do that for this time, this amount of time, we expect you to have these results. If you do this other type of meditation for this other amount of time, you might have this type of results. And it becomes much more fine, because, I mean, for us as followers of the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, it's extremely important, because this, for the tradition we follow, is extremely rich, no, in methods. Like, you cannot say meditation and it's like saying, I don't know, what would be an example? Traveling, you know, what are you traveling by car, by bicycle, by airplane? It's very different.
Yeah, I mean, it's totally funny. I mean, we have all seen these pictures of the experiments of, like, Mathieu Ricard or Minjo Rinpoche with the kind of contact sensors on their head measuring the brain activity. And actually, the scientists could have just asked them, what are you doing? You know?
Yeah.
And kind of... But it was almost like these contemplative scientists didn't want to know what Buddhism has to say about the state. It was like, we want to be objective. We don't want to know what Buddhists think about what's happening in their mind. We just want to measure it and then draw some conclusions based on our measurements, not based on... what these Buddhists think is happening, is going on in their mind.
And especially with Minjo Rinpoche and Mathieu Ricard, we know they come from a background similar to the one we are studying. So we know that they are exposed and probably fluent in a number of types of meditation. So I wonder how, during the research, they would map, whatever the brainwaves were showing with the type of meditation they were doing, because there's tons of them. And some is very, very different from others. And I would expect them to have very, very different short-term and long-term effects on people. So this scientist seems to be... she seemed to be very... Let's see if we can find her name. That would be interesting. She seemed to be very into becoming... precise and specific, which I am very happy about, it because up to now, honestly, personally, I wasn't interested at all in the kind of overlap between science and meditation, because it seemed to me it seems to be like a step back. It's like the language was Willoughby Britton.
Willoughby Britton, yeah. I would have no idea how to pronounce her first name. Willoughby, I guess.
Britton. And, for me, now becomes interesting. If this is the type of precision, the type of specificity that is the background for the discussion, then it becomes really interesting for me. Because, so honestly, to have a whole discussion about is meditation helpful for your mind or for your brain? I say, is jogging helpful for your legs? I mean, what kind of discussion is that? it's really an uninteresting. Uninteresting is really kind of. Anyway, there's very much hope for the future, because she's part of, isn't she, this kind of second generation of Mind and Life Institute.
Yes.
That's exciting, I think.
Yeah, no, it's amazing. She calls it Contemplative Science 2.0.
Yeah, that's...
Yeah, it's really good. I mean...
So I would suggest anybody who's interested in that field to watch that video. Maybe we can... Well, you said we already have the link on our Tumblr page. It's really interesting. It's really interesting. Just because it shows the a direction and a kind of a almost like a second... it's a 2.0. Like, now, okay, now we've done that much research. Now, what do we think about the research we did? You know, it's like... How can we do it better? What is the next way to do it? And I think this is actually the way it should have been done from the beginning, but we have to start somewhere.
Yeah, and she is really entertaining also. I actually had to force David to watch this video.
Yeah.
I had given it to you and he just said, yeah, sure, okay. And then I basically just had to sit down in front of a computer and just play it while you were pretending to play on your phone. But... I captured your attention at least a little bit.
Yeah, 45 seconds is my attention span these days. I worked on it. It used to be less.
So now, coming back to my question, what is it with psychology and Buddhism? I mean, we're not going to answer that, obviously, in a satisfying way. For once, neither of us has studied psychology.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, we have barely studied Buddhism, so they're both looking at the mind, they're looking at what's going on in the mind, but my feeling was Buddhism brings something else, brings a very fundamental view of what's actually beyond the mind. So I think what Buddhism brings to the whole discussion of what's happening in the mind is it brings some distance, actually, because there is an understanding that mind is more than just our thoughts and emotions. There's something Buddha nature or something there beyond that. And thoughts and emotions don't necessarily have to be taken as the most serious thing in the world. I mean, they're serious because they determine totally what we do and how we act. But at the same time, there's no need to kind of totally identify with them.
Yeah, and again, it's such a rich field of practices and approaches in the Buddha Dharma that you would say that there are parts that are quite specifically going beyond the ordinary mind and parts that deal very much with the ordinary mind and try to improve it.
Yes, totally. I mean, we'll have to improve it. There's no way. I mean, it's for now we have it. There's no denying it. We cannot just ignore it. Actually, interestingly, one of our good friends, I mean, friends in the sense of we have heard him talk a lot, John Siracusa from the 5x5 podcast, Hypercritical, he just did a very good podcast last week, and he was talking about that he prefers not to call people something, like he had this thing about geeks being women haters, which are supposedly called misogynist.
Yeah.
And he was saying it's really totally not helpful to tell somebody you're a misogynist, because that puts you in a corner where you're kind of stuck there. And he said it's so much better to tell people that what you do is misogynistic. I have no idea which adjectives. Because when you just tell somebody what you do is that, then you have a chance to change it. Just don't do it anymore. Which is very much, you know, what kind of Dalai Lama says all the time. And I was really surprised to hear that from like one of the top American geeks. The kind of pointing out that there's a huge difference between who you are and what your actions are. In the same way, like who you are and what your mind is. I mean, of course, he didn't go there, but I was seriously impressed, actually. Because it's very insightful to actually separate your actions from who you are. And then, of course, yeah, the next step is to look at your thoughts and emotions. And then Buddhists would say, well, you're not your thoughts and emotions. They just happen to be there. And of course, you cannot say you're not the thoughts and emotions, but you're a little bit more than just that.
Yeah. It is, you know, this is the, where does the Buddha Dharma start? Actually, I think that if you compare it with any type of science, which is supposed to, science is supposed to move towards the future with a, you know, open mind, an inquisitive mind, trying to find out how things are. And you could say that Buddha Dharma has elements of that, because we are moving forward and trying to find out what is in our mind. There's a difference is that some in the Buddha Dharma, the teaching themselves started with somebody who did it and found out a number of things regarding the mind. And the whole thing is built really to help us doing our own kind of research and our own path. But kind of the ending is known, it's a happy ending if everything goes well, but it's not kind of I think I'm trying to say what's the basic difference between any type of Western science and maybe the Buddha Dharma is that it actually takes you by, supposed to take you by the hand and lead you towards a goal that is has been experienced and found to be kind of universally true. And ever since the, you know, Buddha Sakyamuni did it, many individuals did the same. So it has been again and again proven to be correct. Nobody, as far as I know, went through the, you know, the Buddhist path, the Dharma, and then reached enlightenment and then came back and said, no, wait a minute, that was all. It looks completely, it's all green, actually. If you go there, it's all green, and it has this shape, and it works like that. They all kind of come back with a very similar, they basically confirm, yeah, that's what is the ultimate experience or the ultimate status. So in that way, you would expect kind of the Buddha Dharma to be quite different from psychology, also from that point of view, because it's not just for the sake of research. There's something at stake, and there's a specific aim to it.
Yeah, that's certainly true. Yeah.
And then in terms of how much it deals with the ordinary mind, or how much it deals with the kind of the mind that is behind the beyond the mind, again, oh my God! I mean, so many traditions, and within each tradition, so many stages and levels and subtleties. Definitely, any Buddhist tradition does deal at some point with the mind that is beyond the ordinary mind, because that's the whole point.
Yes, yes.
But the way they describe it and the way they lay out a path to get there is quite different. And of course, psychology doesn't do that, right? It deals with the psyche, which is more or less the ordinary mind. And it does something quite interesting, I find. It does zoom into an area, or magnifies an area of the ordinary mind that I haven't found to be as clearly presented in the Dharma, which is, you know, the subconscious. This is like quite, I'm not saying that the Buddha Dharma does not deal with it. I don't know that it describes it in a way that it's as rich as the psychology. So, like the idea that there's another element, sure, that is the mind that is beyond the ordinary mind. And then there is the ordinary mind. But within the ordinary mind, there are elements of the mind you're not aware of, yet they have a huge impact in how you are, how you experience, how you act, and so on. And so I think that's the part that they zoom in and kind of say, okay, it would be helpful for people to become aware of that area and kind of know what's going on there. And I think that's true. I would even think that it's completely compatible with any type of spiritual path.
Yeah, you could probably actually even say that just Buddhists use probably cover a lot of the same territory as the subconscious things with karma, because a lot of what happens on a subconscious level is just implications, what you have done or thought in the past, and kind of these things reappearing and kind of then also influencing that's what you're doing, how you think, how you make decisions, which is exactly what karma does. I mean, it's kind of an influence on what you do, what you feel compelled to do, what you experience, how you experience it. And it's also based on your past actions. Of course, it goes a little bit further in Buddhist teachings. Once you start accepting previous lives, you have much more material to work with.
Yeah. But how do you get... See, with the previous lives, it's like... How do you get access to that? You know, it's quite difficult it's supposed not to be impossible, but it's quite difficult to have a direct experience, or let's call it memory or something like that, of your previous life.
Yeah, definitely. Even of this life.
Whereas in psychology, it's not as difficult to become more aware of your subconscious, depending which level. That even in the subconscious, that it's like a deep sea. There are different levels, you know, could be, you know, 1,000 feet or 2,000 feet down.
Yeah, at the same time, psychology is actually extremely useful also to practitioners, because, yeah, we have all this kind of view, Buddhist view of what's beyond the mind and our Buddha nature and so on, but then we still have to deal with our ordinary mind on an everyday occasion. Even if you want to go in practice, we have to deal with our ordinary mind, who's probably going to tell us that that's not such a good idea. It would be much better to just watch another movie at this point rather than go and sit down.
That's what I mean. Yes, that's what the main thing happens. A friend of mine, I once asked, I think, a lama in I think it was in Kathmandu or something, like something about, shall I more, like, you know, what's the point almost... of training, you know, do I need this ordinary mind to be trained? You know, I've received so many teaching on the, you know, on the nature of mind and the mind that is kind of beyond thoughts and which sometimes we call the wisdom aspect. Shall I not, you know, cultivate that? And and he was saying, like, yeah, but imagine, you know, you're basically in the middle of a jungle. And you need to get out of there. You need a really good machete to kind of cut through all of these things. And that's your training of the ordinary mind. That's what you use. It's how much your ordinary mind is trained gives you the more power to get out of this entanglement in the forest. Whereas you could say, you know, that, well, the wisdom aspect is something much more subtler. It won't help too much if you're in the middle of the jungle to have a very sharp razor, but very small one.
So we need both. And in that respect, I think psychology is totally... I mean, Buddhism would probably be perfectly happy to just take in psychology as a almost... a sub-department somewhere.
Well, that would be interesting if they were to reach the same sharpness that we seem to see happening in at the level of contemplative science, if that type of kind of precision and really deep interest in finding out the details of things were to be applied again to psychology versus Buddha Dharma, which I'm sure there are books out there where people attempt to do that. I'm you know, there cannot be a new idea. But then things can become interesting. I always find, to be honest, as much as I'm interested in both the, you know, the ancient wisdom, if you want, of Buddhism and the modern kind of wisdom of both science, psychology, whatever we have and we are producing in our contemporary culture, as much as I'm interested in the dialogue and to see the parallels and stuff like that, most of the time is quite I don't find it very helpful. The level of dialogue, the type of dialogue, it's very superficial. It's very black and white. It doesn't go into the detail, and often it either needs to be politically correct. You know, it's like one of those nice symposiums where like different representatives of different religions meet, and it's all about, look, we can be on the same stage and we are not declaring a holy war against each other, but actually beyond that there's no real exchange.
Yes. Yeah.
And that what can happen sometime even with psychology, Buddhism, everybody is very nice to each other, very respectful, trying not to step on each other's toes, but then, you know, there's no real kind of, I don't think the result is very useful. It's just very superficial. So I really hope that this, what we've seen here with contemplative science in its recent development, that attitude take on in all other areas of exchange and, you know, comparative sciences, being religions, being Buddha Dharma and psychology and so on, and so that we can get to the critique, and we see also where we disagree, because everybody tried to avoid that, right? Everybody tried to avoid, no, there are actually a few things where we are completely disagreeing, and that's fine.
Yes, and that sounds like actually a very positive note to end on. Well, not the disagreement, but the hope for the future.
Yeah. Excellent.
Yeah.
So, in this wonderful, almost rainy Sunday.
Which is actually beautiful blue sky here. Nice and sunny.
Oh, that's gorgeous. Now here's a grey London sky.
Yeah. It's just melting away the last pieces of snow here.
Oh, you had snow. Wow.
So I think this is going to be our last podcast for this year, I guess, because our schedules, I don't think, would allow us to do one more before the end of the year. But we should be back early next year.
Yeah, in January.
We should definitely try again. And maybe we should invite in psychologists at some point.
Ella, somebody who knows what they're talking about for a
time. Yes, that would be good. So thank you very much for listening. So you find all these things on all these links that we've talked about on safespace2012.tumblr.com. You find us on Twitter. I'm Robert Rickber on Twitter. And we are also safespace2012 on Twitter. And that's it for today. Thank you very much for listening. Bye.
Bye.